what I'd give for that wonderful phrase. To hear those.
Patricia T. O'Connor joins me now. She is the author of Woe Is I and its follow up, Woe Is I Junior. Also, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and she assures me that she's hard at work at another book as well, all of them about the English language. And when she visits us, we talk about the language and take your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our comment line at WNYC.org. And you can also, I'm going to mention it right away, Pat, because I think it's important. You can also check out Pat's blog, see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners at grammarphobia.com. If you want to ask her a question, you can always email her at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. Taking care of business. So what do we want to talk about? You want to talk about words that have double meanings?
Well, the subject came up briefly last time. Someone mentioned, I think, cleave, which means both to be split apart or to cling together. And I thought it might be interesting because so many people wrote to me about those. And I misspoke on the show. I referred to these words as autonyms, and they are sometimes called autoantonyms or autantonyms, but the more common word
sounds
is
like somebody
contronym.
who was speaking for Julius Caesar at a.
But contronyms is the usual contronym, and it's a name that has its contrary parts.
And are there any theories as to why a word like cleave would mean such totally opposite things?
Well, in some cases, some of these contronyms actually come from different sources. And in other cases, they come from the same roots, but they diverged somewhere during history.
A positive became a negative, or vice versa.
Right, right. But other ones are, of course, sanction, which means both approval and prohibition. And oversight has two meanings. Dust, meaning to wipe off or to sprinkle on.
Mm-hmm.
Screen can mean to hide from view or to view. Weather can mean to be eroded by stress or to stand up against it. And there are a lot of other ones. Enjoin, either to forbid or to require. Trim can mean to cut off or to add on. There are a lot of interesting categories of words like that. Another one that I read about recently in Copy Editing Newsletter, which is a good newsletter if you like words.
Copy Editing Newsletter?
Oh, yes. It's a very well-established and widely read newspaper with a very distinguished advisory board. I'm not kidding. Why are you laughing? Now, Paul Martin.
Just tickled my fancy.
Paul Martin of the Wall Street Journal does a regular column in there, and he did one on retronyms. And you know what those are.
No.
A retronym is a word that becomes necessary when the old form of the word is overtaken by history. For example, acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
We never used to have to say acoustic guitar. Or at one time, rotary phone was a retronym when touch-tone phones came in. Now they're both a little bit passé, and we talk about landline phones, meaning ones that aren't cells.
We talk about snail mail.
We talk about snail mail. We talk about tap water, because now everyone drinks bottled water. We talk about analog watches instead of plain watches, push lawnmowers. Cloth diapers, if those exist anymore, and picture tube TVs. So we have to date some of these words as technology overtakes them, and that's what retronyms are. And in fact, Paul Martin writes that the columnist William Safire, who helped popularize the term retronym, has recalled a TV sketch with Sid Caesar portraying a doughboy who proclaims retronymously, "World War I is over."
You got me thinking about whether the Cascade Company still exists. I always wondered why they had that waterfall logo. The people who used to supply diapers to most newborns in New York City.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Cloth diapers?
Yes.
Oh, my.
There was a long time when that's when one of the nicest gifts you could give when a child was born was diaper service.
Right.
Yeah, I think it was usually the Cascade Company.
Yeah.
By the way, our number here is 212-433-9692. Obviously, as the world changes, the language has to adjust.
Exactly. And as news events happen, corporations have to adjust. And I have corporate euphemism of the month, if you'd like to hear it.
Please.
You remember the heparin scandal?
Yes.
Of a couple of weeks ago with the poisoned blood thinners. The company involved in importing some of the ingredients that went into these poisoned blood thinners said, well, it referred to the deaths that resulted from the poisoned blood thinner as adverse events. So there you go. They're capable of anything.
I think that they probably found somebody from the Department of Defense.
Yes.
Come up with that
they
kind of thing.
They didn't call it collateral damage. But I would think that if you were a family member of one of those 19 people who supposedly died, although that's probably a low number, I don't think you'd enjoy hearing it referred to as an adverse event.
No.
Which is odd because I think if corporations were upfront, they would sound better.
Yes.
I don't know why they go to such trouble to sound cold and heartless.
In fact, when Johnson & Johnson apologized for the poisoning of some of their product, mm-hmm. people applauded.
Exactly.
They were very straightforward.
Uh-huh.
And I think we always appreciate that. We know when somebody is trying to slither
exactly.
out of something.
Exactly. And a simple thing like, gee, we made a mistake. We're sorry. What's so hard about saying that?
Well, with that in mind, should we take some calls?
Yes, let's do.
Okay, our number is 212-433-9692. I'm Leonard Lopate here with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of a number of books about the English language. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. And Helen from Larchmont, you're on the air.
My question is not related to what you've just been discussing, but I've
We're just talking about the language here, Helen. Anything that you want to talk about is fine with us.
I have heard so frequently people referring to the amount of people attending the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct or isn't that incorrect?
Well, I would say it's not really standard usage. Usually you would say the number of people. But you'd say the amount of something that was uncountable. Say the amount of noise made by that huge number of people was astonishing.
But when referred to people,
mm-hmm.
how
numbers.
Could that be correct?
Numbers. You'd say the number of people,
yeah.
not the amount of people.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you mm-hmm. so much. By the way, we also get write-ins from on our comment line. And this person asks, do next to last and second to last mean the same thing? Many people use them that way, but I've always felt that they don't. To my mind, next to last means first to last or penultimate, mm-hmm. while second to last means antepenultimate.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
It's interesting. Someone else emailed me about that
maybe
after
this
the last
person.
Show. Maybe that's the same person. I think there's a difference, but I may be wrong. In my opinion, next to last means the same thing as second to last. In other words, antepenultimate. Or penultimate. Penultimate, I'm sorry. But when you look these things up in the dictionary, it's you could read it either way. You could say second to last is either the one in front of the very last one or it's the one just in front of that. So I did answer the person who emailed, but I think you could read it either way. In my opinion, next to last means the same thing as penultimate.
The big problem with penultimate is that some people don't even know what it means. One of the more difficult moments on the show for me was when a very famous author, a man who had written a book that had not only sold millions of copies but also had been made into one of the most popular films of the time, said, Leonard, that was the penultimate experience for me. And I said, well, if that was the, no, I don't remember what he was talking about. I said, well, if that was the penultimate, what was the ultimate? He said, but Leonard, that was the penultimate. And I didn't want to correct him, so we just moved on.
Yeah, I think second to last is the same, although I think you could argue that second to the last is actually the third in line from the very end. You could make that argument, but I don't buy it.
We go now to Bernie from White Plains. Hi, Bernie, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I'd like to suggest another contronym, like let, which, mm-hmm. of course, you know, is to allow, but it means also to hinder, as in without let or hindrance.
Uh-huh.
That expression. And then there's a...
Although that is a bit obscure,
it's
Bernie.
It's obscure, right.
I have to give you an even more obscure one. There's an etymological contronym. How's that? An old English, you know, word quena, K-W-E-N-E, means... In modern English, is queen,
uh-huh.
but when it gets to Scottish, it becomes Q-U-E-A-N, which means a whore. So you got a big diversion
oh.
that way.
Mm. Huh.
That may have been a comment on the British monarchy at one point or another.
Or that, you know, the bifurcated view of women that is, goes around.
Thank you for calling us.
Okay, right, bye.
Eddie from Brooklyn Heights, huh? You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just noticed a few years ago people started referring to regular shirts that you button as button-down shirts. And when I was growing up, a button-down shirt referred to the collar.
It still does, doesn't
it? Yeah, that's what I always thought.
Well, but younger people only wear T-shirts, and if they wear a dress shirt, they call it a button-down shirt.
Oh, so the phrase button-down collar, I guess, is going to become a retronym.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling us.
Okay.
A listener writes in, why do people say direct descendant? Is there such a thing as an indirect descendant?
Well, maybe by direct descendant, they mean they actually follow in the parental grandparent line and so on, rather than from an aunt. For example, Princess Diana was not a direct descendant of the 17th century Duchess of Devonshire. Mm-hmm. Who was a Spencer, but she was related through her aunt's line. So, again...
Well, why would we even... I mean, that is...
Yeah, I know.
It's stretching it. Well, you know...
I would say a descendant
I once
is
sat next to somebody who knew somebody.
Yeah. But, you know, what I've always wanted to know, as far as consanguinity, I guess, if that's the word, what is a cousin... once removed or twice removed? I've never been able to find a satisfactory answer to that. I think of a second cousin as my mother's cousin, is my second cousin. Other people say, no, that's not your second cousin. That's your cousin once removed. But I don't know. If anyone knows what this removed business is, let me know.
Well, we once had a dinner and we had to have a cousin removed.
I've got a couple cousins like that, too.
Judith from South Orange, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, and thank you so much for this show. It's such a pleasure to listen to you both. My question has to do with Valentine's Day. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, I remembered that it was still referred to as St. Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And in my old dictionary, my old Webster's dictionary from the 70s, it's still listed as St. Valentine's Day. But when Valentine's Day came around this year, I was surprised how many people had no clue what St. Valentine's Day was. And I was wondering if you have an idea when this changed in our culture, that the saint part was dropped.
Well, I don't know that it's actually been dropped. Maybe it's just been sort of pushed into the background. But most people do think of St. Valentine's Day as just plain Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm. We've taken the religious aspects
out of it. We forget
that
there was a saint involved.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still there somewhere.
But that, don't you think it's because it's become a secular holiday?
I suppose, yes, that was my thought, that it has become a secular holiday. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering when this shift happened. It was so subtle, I didn't even realize that it was happening. And I woke up one day, and there is no St. Valentine's Day anymore.
Hmm.
And that aspect tends to get played down.
Well, I can see why. For example, if you were a manufacturer of cards, and they probably sell a vast amount of cards on Valentine's Day, you would probably want everyone to buy them and not just Christians. And St. Valentine was a Christian saint or martyr. So I think it would be in your interest to secularize this as much as you could. And make it more like Mother's Day.
Isn't this different than Christmas? Many people, cultural conservatives mostly, are concerned that the religious aspect of Christmas is being lost. Mm-hmm. But still, you're not going to take the Christ out of Christmas.
No, but you can easily buy secular cards. They're available. So it's almost possible to pretend or imagine that it's another secular holiday.
And there are some people who prefer happy holidays.
Yeah, exactly. Season's greetings.
Well.
So there you go.
I should give out the phone number again, right? 212-433-9692. We'll take a little break and we will be back with more. This is The Leonard Lopate Show with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of 4 books and counting about the English language. And we're taking your calls on the English language.
Oh, baby, what I'd give to hear those 3 little words.
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and most recently Word Is I, Junior, addressed to the juniors in our midst. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Lynn from Morristown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys?
We are well.
Great.
Or good, whatever makes you happy.
A question. Could you please use the word myriad correctly in a sentence? So, for example, do you say a myriad of something, or do you just say myriad something, myriad people? Do you know what I'm saying? Or myriad of people?
Well, this is another usage that's changed. I used to believe that you only used myriad, or you used myriad only in the sense of an adjective. You'd say there are myriad reasons,
right?
As if you'd use it as a number.
Exactly. That's what I thought. But then I hear people say myriad of questions or whatever.
Right. But usage guides now accept that, a myriad of something. Because at one time it meant, I think, 10,000. I'll check that out. In ancient times it referred to 10,000 of something. So to say a myriad of, you could argue that it means a 10,000 unit chunk of
that's
something.
A lot.
Yeah, yeah. And people don't mean myriad like that anymore.
You have to fall back on slew to get past
right.
that.
Actually, yeah, it comes from the Greek morias, 10,000, countless. But as American Heritage says, throughout a lot of its history, it was used as a noun, a myriad of men. And it's only people like me only started thinking along around about the 19th century that it should be used as an adjective. So I guess it's difficult to misuse it now. So,
okay.
Yeah, anything goes.
Thank you very much.
And we thank you for calling us. We have some other comments that have come in. This person says, pithily, lessen or reduce, huge pet peeve.
Well,
can we do something to reduce that anger or lessen it?
Or lessen it. I guess I would have to understand the context in which the person is peeved, because it seems to me that they are interchangeable in a lot of senses.
Mm-hmm.
To lessen your reliance, say, on or reduce your carbon footprint, or to lessen your reliance on carbon-based products
both
or something.
Fine.
Yeah, I don't.
Perhaps because
maybe
I think it's a she. Concerned with the fact that they use in the same sentence, you may have to adjust the sentence for each word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it's the less and few. Is that the, because a lot of people are very bothered by that.
But that's a whole other thing. And less and few, do we want to clear that up again?
Well, I don't know, but I did get an interesting email about that. Remember last month, the listener in Brooklyn, Ann Kirshner, who wrote to Allstate and got them to grammatically correct their full-page ads about, how much retirement do you need or how much of a retirement should you plan for, or mm-hmm. something like that. Well, now she is she's taking on Starbucks.
Will I have to pay less for a latte?
They've got signs that say less napkins, more plants.
Ooh,
more
less
planet,
napkins.
Less napkins. So she's suggesting they ought to say either less paper or mm-hmm. fewer napkins. So because we'll see how they respond.
Because paper does get less. It's like uh-huh. ice cream. You mm-hmm. get you have less ice cream, but you have fewer ice cream cones.
Yes, yes.
It
and
seems
similarly,
clear
you
to
could
me.
Reduce. You could reduce the number of napkins, or you could lessen your napkin usage.
But then what about when we say nine or less? Should we really be saying nine or fewer?
Well, I would. But
all the supermarkets have that wrong.
Not all of them. There are some who say have over one of their aisles 10 items or fewer. Some of them do. I wonder if it raises eyebrows among the shoppers. But again, this is another thing where usage guides are loosening up a lot and saying, look, it's not that big a deal.
But not big of a deal.
Not that,
we're not going to accept that one.
It is that big of a deal.
A lot of people are upset about people saying that not that big of a deal.
Yeah, that bothers me too. I think it's more important when we talk about using the wrong pronouns or a subject-verb agreement or that kind of thing, those bigger grammatical problems.
Let's go to Barry from Middlebury, New Jersey. Hi, Barry.
Hello, it's Milburn, actually, and I have an of question, and I must say I'm irked by the same of problem you are. I've noticed lately that people say couple times, or I'm going out with a couple friends instead of a couple of times and couple of friends.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening there in the language?
Well, I think, again, it's just a dropped of. The standard usage is to use of with a couple of, in the same way that you'd say a brace of pheasants, because a couple used to mean a coupling. So you wouldn't say a coupling friends, you'd say a coupling of friends. So you should think of it as a noun,
a
number.
We used to say a couple of friends.
A couple of friends.
But then he became a filmmaker and we couldn't do that anymore. Okay.
Oh,
anyway.
Was that a joke?
Yeah, it was a bad joke.
Went past me.
Okay. Paul from Richmond, you're on the air.
Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Oh, Ridgewood. Oh. Hi.
Great show. Thank you very much. Very, very and important. I didn't call about this, but I was always led to believe that somebody once removed was a child of, so child of a first cousin is a first cousin once removed. Grandchild is twice removed, et cetera, so on.
So it's basically the same as second cousin, third cousin?
Well, the second cousin would be the concurrent children of first cousins are second cousins. So my first cousin's children are my children's second cousins.
Your children's second cousins.
Right, for instance, my daughter to my first cousin is a first cousin once removed. Her child, if it's my cousin's child, is my daughter's second cousin.
You've opened up a can of worms here. We have about six calls coming in on this.
I think I understand.
Anyway, I was just calling about homophones that mean sort of opposite things like raise and raise.
Mm-hmm.
To take down or to lift up.
Right.
Oral and oral, right.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
What about them, Paul?
Okay.
Oh, you just wanted to mention them. Okay. But it can get a little confusing, can't it?
Yeah, it can. I'm not sure I can keep that in my mind, that business about the once removed is your children's, your cousin's children and your children our first cousins once removed. That's the children. But why wouldn't they just be second cousins or third? I don't know.
Well, all the people who called in to answer that have now hung up. So,
oh.
Or hanged up.
They can email me then. I would like to know this.
Hanged and hung is another one. With,
yeah,
especially with pictures.
I would say they've hung up the phone.
Yeah, but do you hang a picture or have?
You hang a picture,
mm-hmm.
but once it is on the wall, it is hung, not hanged.
And was the man who was given capital punishment hung or hanged?
Hanged.
Okay.
But I wouldn't want to be either one.
Unless he's your second cousin.
Yeah.
Lori from Hoboken. Hi, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you. You were talking earlier about retronyms, and I think I have one.
Uh-huh.
Well, so you talked about landline versus cell phone.
Uh-huh.
But during the New York City blackout in 2003,
mm-hmm.
we started using the term corded phone because cordless phones, because they relied on electricity, were useless. But I went home and I got out my old phone with a cord, and it worked just fine. And nobody wants to say phone with a cord, so we say corded phone.
Ah, okay.
Have you heard it?
No, I haven't. I've always just heard it, you know, landline or the phone that actually is plugged into the wall.
Right.
I guess you don't see too many corded phones anymore, so it doesn't come up much.
It doesn't come up very much, but it was very, very important during the blackout because, you know, like I said, cordless phones, even if they're landlines,
mm-hmm.
had to relied on electricity. They
right.
plugged into
they
the
don't
wall.
Work. I know. That I live out in the country, and when our electricity goes off, we have to rely on our corded phones because the ones that you can walk around with don't work.
Exactly. And I'm calling you on it right now.
Thank you. Actually, most of the phones in offices are corded phones.
Oh.
I don't have a cordless phone in my office.
Well, I guess if they weren't, the employees could walk away with them accidentally or leave them places, and the company would never know.
Right.
Where's this phone?
Well, they might assume that I was at my desk when I was actually somewhere totally different.
Yeah.
Another caller has called in to say that once removed is generational. A first cousin's child is a first cousin once removed.
Oh, that makes sense. I always referred to my cousin's children as my second cousins, but I guess I was wrong in that.
You'll never do it again.
Never.
My guess,
I don't know. I can't promise anything.
My guess is Patricia T. O'Connor, who finally understands first and second cousins. I have totally blocked this out, I have to tell you. If somebody tested me on this, I would fail. She is the author of a number of books on the English language, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We've gotten any number of comments on our comment line, and here's a problem, because this person asks, how do you pronounce columnist? Now, I pronounce it columnist. Is
mm-hmm.
there another way of pronouncing it? C-O-L-U-M-N-I-S-T?
Well, that's how I pronounce it, too. I guess he maybe is suggesting that you can say columnist.
But does anybody?
But I don't. I've never heard that pronunciation. I mean, I've never heard that it's proper. Let me just check it out here.
We did have a bit of a disagreement on the previous month, because I say February.
Right.
And nobody else does.
Nobody does.
And I still think it should be pronounced that way.
Well, you're probably right, but you're a better man than we are.
But it doesn't bother me. You know, one of the things, and we have to address this once again, one of the things that I'm always stunned by is that people are so bothered by these things. It's okay to me if someone mispronounces a word, unless it is a person of great authority who can't pronounce the word nuclear or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, if somebody in a shop mispronounces a word, I don't feel superior. I just, you know, fine.
Yeah, they're all kind of, actually, I've learned something new here. This is a lesson. Proves what you were just saying. Columnist. The first pronunciation given is columnist. The second one is columnist.
So it is columnist.
That's the, yeah.
Oh,
and there's
my
no
gosh.
There's no note saying that it's substandard or anything. The fact that it's second might just mean that it's slightly less common. But, huh.
Here's one from a listener, a comment. I've heard this from very eloquent personalities on NPR. I don't know if this is directed at me. In 10 minutes from now, and this person wonders, wouldn't it be in 10 minutes or 10 minutes from now?
Right.
But
yeah.
Can you not say in 10 minutes from now?
Well, I think it sounds
redundant.
Silly. Yeah.
Okay.
Like saying, in 2 weeks from today, mm-hmm. I will be going on vacation. You wouldn't say...
No, I say 2 weeks hence.
Oh, please. Come on.
Okay,
well,
so
well, you say
I
schism.
Don't.
You're the only person I know who says schism, although I know it's the correct way, but you're the only person I know who says
and
that.
I may be the only person who says fort these days. Well, what the heck.
Okay.
You know, years ago, when I came to WNYC, I had a boss who wanted to catch me on these things, and he gave me this announcer's test.
Uh-huh.
And he was really upset.
And did it have schism and fort?
No,
in
but
it
had exquisite and words
oh,
like that.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know why. Maybe because I'm an autodidact.
I guess so. But,
because,
you know.
Because I think people, if you grow up, for example, the word herb,
uh-huh.
H-E-R-B.
Right.
There really is a difference if you make a certain amount of money. Julia Child always pronounced it herb.
Uh-huh.
Martha Stewart pronounces it herb.
She does?
Yes.
Oh. Huh. Well, that's not the standard American pronunciation. That's unusual in the U.S. to
yes,
say
but
herb.
People do it, and I think that probably Nelson Rockefeller pronounced it
herb. Well, you know,
herb.
Nelson Rockefeller had a bit of the Anglophile in his accent, and it may be that people who say herb and anhistoric mm. have a bit of the Anglophile in them.
Yes. Kate from, what is it, Garden City. Hi, Kate.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. You have to make it quick.
Okay. I just wanted to bring up the modern usages that are huge pet peeves of mine. One is beginning sentences with the incorrect pronouns of me, her,
mm-hmm.
him, and I.
Mm-hmm.
And the other...
Such as?
Sorry?
Give me an example. Me?
Me and her went to lunch yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Drives me absolutely crazy. And the other is the usages of like.
Mm. I'm probably not going to be as sympathetic with you on the usages of like. One usage I like is the quotative like. I did a column on this for the Times last summer and got a lot of flack.
I mean, he goes like...
Right. I think that's an innovative kind of usage that is probably here to stay because it allows you to not quote someone directly. You can also quote someone's intentions. I mean, quote in a figurative sense, or his thoughts. You can be approximate with it. It's a very flexible usage.
So he goes like, "Ech," and I go, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Well, if you want to get in touch with Patricia T. O'Connor, you can email her at mailbox@grammarphobia.com, or you can check out some of the things she's writing about on her blog at grammarphobia.com. She will be back with us on April 16th, and I look forward to that. And you can always read any of her books, Woe Is I, You Send Me, Words Fail Me, or Woe Is I Junior. That's for the kiddies. I look forward to seeing you again, Pat.
Me too. Bye.
On tomorrow's show, guest host Julie Burstein looks into whether there's ever such a thing as a good war with Nicholson Baker. Also, poet Mark Doty on his new collection, Serdwyn Dovey's debut novel, Bloodkin, and our latest underreported. And I'll be back on Friday when NPR's ombudsman will be here, and we would like to know whether you have any questions about how NPR shapes its news and political coverage. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Samantha Morgenstern and Dina Mann. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.